You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
Everyone these days could use a little support, and your friends at the ESO Network are no different. With the ESO Network Patreon, the cool thing is when you help support us, it's you who will benefit. With four tiers starting for as little as 25 cents a week, you can listen to some of your favorite network podcasts early, hear exclusive content, maybe get some ESO swag, or even possibly take a shot at the geek seat. All you need to do is sign up at patreon.com/ESO Network.
I'm Drew Leiter.
And I'm Cletus Jacobs.
And welcome to episode 156 of the Earth Station DCU. Tonight we're going to talk Aquaman number 49, Batman number 73, Justice League number 26, Supergirl issues 29, 30, 31, Swamp Thing season 1 episode 4, Darkness on the Edge of Town, and Swamp Thing season 1 episode 5, Drive All Night. But before we get into that, let's talk some DC news. All right, Cletus, coming up first for DC news. Joe Hill, son of Stephen King, is launching a horror-themed DC Comics line. Even with Vertigo closing down shop, the imprint's legacy for publishing scary stories will live on with Hill House Comics, which is clearly named after the Shirley Jackson novel that gives its name to the popular Netflix series, The Haunting of Hill House. Joe will get the ball rolling with these five limited series. Basket Full of Heads. A woman comes in possession of a very special axe that cuts off heads in one fell swoop, but keeps them alive to speak. The next one is The Dollhouse Family. Alice continues to revisit the magical family of dollhouses inhabiting a dollhouse she was given as a child. The next one is Low Woods. A Pennsylvania mining town grapples with a strange plague that feasts on memories. The next title is called Plunge. It's a homage to the works of H.P. Lovecraft and John Carpenter. This tale takes readers to the frozen Arctic, where a research vessel thought to be missing for 40 years has mysteriously resurfaced. And the last title is called Daphne Byrne. A girl in 19th century New York discovers that her body is playing host to an evil being. Were you surprised that they were launching this horror-themed DC line after we just talked about them going to their age requirement thing last week?
Yeah, I mean, I think I want to clarify, this project is super cool. I think I'm very glad DC's doing it. I think it's really cool. But also, like, are multiple people making different decisions here? Like, it just seems like the left hand doesn't know what the right hand's doing.
Yeah, because they're sending two different messages. One, we want to get rid of imprints. Oh, wait a minute. The very next week, we had an imprint. New imprint. It's like, what?
I mean, this one totally makes sense as an imprint. Like, frankly, none of these would make sense published under DC. In my opinion, they make sense to be published under a different imprint, as did a number of other titles, so I don't know why they got rid of them in the first place.
Yes, a lot of the Vertigo titles didn't really belong under the DC line, which is why they had the imprint in the first place. So I don't know what crazy thing they're doing.
The thing I wonder is if by getting rid of imprints, they're trying to get away from DC being just known as superheroes. But in that case, if you want to do that, you got to commit to that. You have to, I mean, like, pick. You have to pick one. You can't do both.
Exactly. So I don't understand. I mean, they could easily publish these under the DC line too, which would show more diversity under the DC line, but. You know, if they're going to have separate imprints, why get rid of the rest of them?
Yeah, I agree. The big takeaway from this, though, is that DC is doing something really cool, taking a chance, I think, on a different kind of project. It's just we're getting mixed messages on what the goal of the company is, I feel like.
I agree with you. And there'll be some people, the horror community, in general, will gravitate towards these titles. So I think it's really cool. All right, and for our next bit of DC news, Netflix has optioned DC's The Sandman as a live-action show, according to The Hollywood Reporter. Alan Heinberg has reportedly signed on as showrunner chief writer with Neil Gaiman and David S. Goyer on board as executive producers. This move would follow Netflix's taking over Fox's Lucifer, which itself was a spinoff of the Sandman comic book series.
I've actually been watching the new season of Lucifer on Netflix, and it's been good. It's been the usual Lucifer show, which I personally enjoy, but it's unique and also not an adaptation. We talked about this, I think, when we were talking about Swamp Thing. It's not an adaptation of only in name is it an adaptation of Lucifer. This is pretty cool news. They had almost made a movie a handful of years ago. I want to say, I could be wrong about this. I want to say James Franco was involved in it. I don't know if that's right or not. There was a big actor that was involved in it, and they were going to be making a movie, and then they didn't end up doing it. And I might have the actor wrong, but it just never got off the ground. It kind of just got stuck in pre-production or whatever it was, and never really came to fruition. So we'll see if this fares any better. I mean, it probably will. Netflix has just godly amounts of money to throw at projects, so.
Yeah. Yeah, it's because this article says The Sandman has been in development as a TV show or movie on multiple occasions, going all the way back to the mid-90s.
Yeah. So. I mean, it was such it's such a well-known comic. A lot of people, fans have wanted to get an adaptation of it, but also, like, if you're just looking from a business end, like, you know, there's like a very large audience that would want to see it. So, I think it's cool. I'm also, just because it's been rumored so many other times before, I'm kind of in a wait and see mode to see if they actually do make it.
So, and it'll fit right in on Netflix, especially with some of their other stuff like Black Mirror and some of the other, you know, programs like that on there.
Yeah.
So
I think, there's no question it would have a very eager audience if it does get made. Whether the show is good, we won't know. But I mean, the matter of having an audience is definitely not the issue with this show.
All right. Well, that wraps up our DC news for this week. Let's take a short break. And when we come back, we'll do our comics talk.
Look, we know it's a long time till Doctor Who comes back on the air.
Sorry.
But your friends here at the Earth Station Who podcast are here to help.
That's right. Mike, and Mary will be your guide through this wilderness year with reviews of classic stories, audios, and even some group discussions featuring some special guests.
Join us for new episodes every other week up on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever fine podcasts are found.
The Earth Station Who podcast, exploring over 50 years of the Doctor Who universe.
And we're back, but before we get into this week's comic books talk, we gotta let you know there's gonna be spoilers.
We got spoilers.
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 We got spoilers.
Spoilers
for you. We got spoilers.
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 We've got spoilers.
Spoilers
for you. For you.
All right, let's talk Aquaman number 49. When the issue opens up, Aquaman is conversing with Mother Shark, and she returns his memories of Mira. We learn that Mira is of the prison colony Zabel. She is heir to the throne of an angry people whose forefathers were wrong, cast out of Atlantis, denied its protections and resources, and confined within an alternate dimension. They were forced to live as scavengers. And resentment and hatred grew with each generation with that people. Mira was reared as an agent of vengeance and meant to kill Atlantis' king. Instead, her judgment proved more sound than her training, and Mira chose to love the one she was sent to kill. And she eventually became the Queen of Atlantis. Then we see another memory of Mira and Aquaman in which they're having a conversation about how they're going to make their relationship work because she's the Queen of Atlantis while Arthur lives on land and he has his commitments to the Justice League. They decide they want to make things work. Mira tells Arthur that she is pregnant. Arthur freaks out and wants to leave to clear his head. And this puts a fear in Mira. And then she kind of gets angry and loses control of her power. This is due to a moodiness, which is a side effect of pregnancy, I'm sure. Because having four kids, I've seen this before. And of course, she loses her control and accidentally kills Arthur, which we see is why Aquaman was dead. Because we were both curious about that before.
Well, this seems to be a semi-retcon in that he was supposedly had died in the Justice League. Yeah, the Drowned Earth story. But this comic, at least if we read it the same way, seems to suggest that he survived that. But nobody knew that, which is weird. And then Mira accidentally kills him. The first part of this is not new. That's basically them rehashing Mira's origin, but the whole idea of her being raised an assassin and then changing her mind once she meets Arthur is pretty consistent with Mira's story.
Okay, and I was unfamiliar with Mira's story.
It's different from the movie, obviously, but yeah, that is it. At least I can't speak to old Aquaman comics, but I know that is consistent with at least the New 52, if not before that.
And that's what I had a feeling was consistent with the New 52. I don't know Mira's origin before that either. So I was unfamiliar with that. But I found it very interesting. I'm like, oh, this is an interesting take on Mira. And this is an interesting situation they're in because I'm curious when Aquaman actually returns how things are going to go.
Yeah.
Now, I thought it was interesting. Mother Shark just didn't return Arthur to Atlantis. She returned him to the old gods.
Yeah, I thought that was odd, too, because I thought the whole thing was that she was going to bring him back.
Yeah. But I do remember that the old gods had sent him to Mother Shark to get his memory back. But I always assumed he was just going to go on home from there.
Yeah.
So I'm kind of curious how he gets back to the real world. If that, it sounds like this is going to take him. It might take him a whole issue. Maybe it'll just be beginning of next issue when they send him back. I'm very curious to see what's going to happen, and how the old gods are going to fit into it, and how Calais, she was there also. If she's going to go back with Aquaman, I'd be very interested in that, because they have a connection too. So.
We also are going to get Black Manta as well.
Oh, yes. I saw that at the end of the issue, Return of Black Manta.
Which is a bit foreboding when you consider it that we're dealing with a story with Mira and Aquaman's kid.
Yeah.
So, we'll see. I've really been enjoying this Aquaman title, and this was no exception. I'm intrigued to get more... I'm hoping we get a little more clarification on that. We have our timeline right, that he did survive and then accidentally died after that. So yeah, I'm just curious to get more story out of this. I certainly enjoyed this issue, though.
I did as well. All right, well, let's move on to our next title for this week, Batman number 73. This issue opens up with Thomas Wayne riding a horse through the desert with an unconscious Bruce on his back and dragging a coffin through the sand. And he is singing merrily as they travel. I gotta tell you, Cletus, I really like this issue a lot. Number one, it cleared up what Thomas Wayne's goal was. And it was just interesting to see Thomas Wayne happy at what has happened.
I agree. I also enjoyed this issue. This is definitely, I would say, the weirdest story we've gotten, though.
Yes.
which is weird to say, because we've gotten some bizarre stories from King's Run in a good way. But, like, this one was just weird. We've got the Flashpoint Batman, and he's singing a song, and he's dragging what appears to be his dead wife behind him, and we'll see if that's the case or not. That's what they said, is that it's the mom, but then the like little mini summary for the next issue seemed to imply that maybe that was not the case.
Okay, I don't remember what the summary said, but it was pretty plain that was Martha when I was reading the story.
Yeah.
And
I agree with you. I was like, that totally makes sense. But then, and again, I mean, maybe the summary is just doing that because if you hadn't read this issue, it didn't want to give that away.
Oh, maybe that's
the only thing I could think of.
But yeah,
I'm very, very curious to see the next issue just because this was just so outlandish. It was like, whoa, outlandish. And yet everything within the comic itself is completely like relatively normal. It's just a guy riding through the desert.
Right, on a horse with no name. I was wondering why he wasn't singing that song. Thomas Wayne must have took him, fixed his back, because he said he fixed Bruce's back, and Bruce was on the drugs. So when Bruce wakes up, he's like, you know, you'll understand more what's going on when the drugs wear off. You know, and of course, Ra's al Ghul's personal guard keeps attacking them along the way, because he's headed to a Lazarus pit. Thomas Wayne's plan is to resurrect his wife and, I guess, give Bruce the family he's lost so he has no reason to be Batman. That was my take on what his goal was. Do you agree with that?
I mean, as of now, yeah.
I personally think that things are not going to go the way Thomas Wayne plans on it.
No way. I mean, there's no way. Because if his mission is what he says it is to have Bruce never need or want to be Batman again, we would not have a Batman comic. We all know that's not happening. So.
Well, yeah, of course. I'm just kind of interested in how this is going to go south. So.
Yeah.
Very excited for reading the next issue.
Agreed.
Of course, we're gonna come across Ra's al Ghul. It's almost a certainty. All right, well, let's move on to our next issue for this week, Justice League number 26. So this issue opens up with Martian Manhunter searching desperately for the Cloaked Man. And this Cloaked Man is an urban legend of a man who would come and help you make your cruelest desires a reality. And they always called him the Cloak Man, but of course, John saw his identity clear in each of the tellings that it was Lex Luthor. And another part of this issue, we see Superman addresses the House of Heroes, informing the rest of the multiverse that what was going on in the main DC universe. And the World Forger was there with him also, asking for help in finding both of his Monitor brothers. Back on Earth, we see that Hawk Girl is kind of coordinating the different groups of heroes at the Hall of Justice, as they're each playing their part in the search for the Legion of Doom and Perpetua, and also training to get ready for the coming battle. But we see Hawk Girl talking with Mira of her frustration that, you know, she needs to find John Jones and he's not answering her. When we get to the end of the issue, Martian Manor has tracked down the Cloaked Man to an old abandoned farmhouse, and he discovers the identity of the Cloaked Man is not Lex Luthor, but Lionel Luthor. I found that very interesting. And how they're bringing it back around to when Lionel Luthor had Martian Manhunter captured when he was a child.
There were some really good scenes in this. I really enjoyed, in particular, the multiverse scene. I really like, you know, I'm a sucker for that.
Oh, yeah. Captain Carrot. I love seeing him.
Exactly.
And he kind of looked like larger in life how they had him drawn too.
Yeah. I also loved all the seeing Hawk Girl and Mira kind of wandering through the different parts of the Hall of Justice and interacting with different teams. Like, we saw the Teen Titans, we saw the like team of detectives all trying to figure out where the Legion of Doom is hiding out. All of that was just, there's some really cool stuff in this comic. I really enjoyed it.
Yes. I was happy to see the Terrifics also shown in there.
Yeah.
One of the other scenes I liked also was, I liked Barry and John Stewart kind of talking back and forth when they were at House of Heroes. Because John was like, how can you be so comfortable with this? And Flash is like, yeah, I've been through this several times. So I thought that was kind of cool also. I really enjoyed this issue also. Thought it was great. And I'm looking forward to seeing more of this story unfolding. All right, well, let's move on to our last title for this week. Supergirl 29, 30, and 31. So in Supergirl number 29, the issue opens up with Supergirl, Xander, and Krypto enjoying some downtime. We see Krypto kind of finds a crystal, and we see the axe of Rogel Zar activate all the crystals they had gathered so far, and the image of Appa Alla Apsa and his final testament is revealed. So we learn basically nothing in the Superman title, and we learn a whole bunch in these last three issues of Supergirl.
But this almost seemed by like accident. Like, this clearly was not, I do not think that issues 29 through 30 were meant to be the conclusion to the story. It almost seems like the end caught them off guard. You know what I mean? Like, it seems like Bendis was like, hey, I need Supergirl to pop back in. Like, I'm ready to bring this story back together, so you need to wrap it up. I should say Ben and the Superman editorial team in general. Because, like, this came out of nowhere.
I know it did.
Literally within the story, Krypto just randomly finds the things to complete the message. Like, that is clearly a writer pulling something out of nowhere to be like, here's the explanation.
I know. It's kind of like they're like, finish up your storyline. We need Supergirl back.
You cannot convince me that this was how they meant to wrap this story up. There is no way.
We reviewed the last issue, 28. It did not look like it was going into the story. I had told you that, you know, this is dragging on, and I wanted to just kind of drop it for now. I was not expecting it to wrap the story up and give us all the information we needed that wasn't even in Superman.
Yeah.
It was kind of crazy.
So it gave us most of the answers. The only one it didn't give us that, frankly, was the one that I actually wanted was why Rogel Zar, like, what actually happened. Like, they say that Krypton destroyed, but we already knew that, but we still haven't. Am I crazy? I feel like we haven't gotten a sufficient explanation with that.
No, we haven't. And when we get to issue 31, that's what I got out of Kara's that's not what her mission is. You're right. They do state that Rogel Zar, the Krypton had attacked his people or destroyed his people. That's why he wanted revenge. But there was no reason given why Krypton would have attacked their people or any reason why. So that's still a mystery, and I imagine
that's going to get resolved in Superman. Seems like the Bendis side of the story.
Yeah, it does. And we know that Jor-El and Kal-El are on their way back to Krypton, or what's left of Krypton, or they're doing something with Krypton. So I think you're right. We're going to get our answer from Bendis on that one. Because in issue 31 of Supergirl is when we see the reunion with Supergirl, Superman, and Superboy, John. And Supergirl and John are going off on a mission back to she wants to confront Gandola, which let's get into why the Circle was formed here. So we learned the Circle was formed and assembled in secret to keep the peace. Basically, the Circle consists of Appa Alla Apsa, Sardath of Ran, which I didn't recognize that name, the Thanagarian Defense Minister, King Myandri of Tamaran, and then Empress Gandilo of the 14 sons. Now we find out that Gandilo, she was not content to be a reactive force, which was what they were. She wanted to be more proactive, and against the council's wishes, she started targeting planets that she felt were blights, ones that exhausted the resources and decimated their ecosystems. So she started destroying them. We also learned that when the Circle had found Rogal Zar, he was the last of his race, and he was filled with rage. They thought it made him an ideal warrior for the Circle, because no one would question his actions as a warmonger, because he was full of hate. But the Circle had trouble controlling him, and when he wanted revenge against Krypton, they told him no. And Gandilo made a deal with Rogal Zar that she would help him eliminate Krypton with a device she stole and reverse engineered from scientist Zor-El, which was Supergirl's father, in exchange for Rogal Zar's devotion to her. Then we see in issue number 30, we get the fallout between Xander and Supergirl. And
I want to jump in right here.
Go ahead.
So you're right. So issue 30 starts with Supergirl ripping into that guy, which makes no... I legitimately had to go back and check to see if these issues were written by different people. It makes no narrative sense from issue 29 to issue 30. It's like two different people wrote those stories. So issue 29, Supergirl learns all this stuff and learns that he was adopted by this woman who is essentially responsible, in large part responsible for the destruction of her planet. And she explicitly says, you are not responsible for the sins of your mother. Right? In issue 29.
Right, in issue 29, I agree with you there.
She is in no way holding him even 1% accountable. And then issue 30 starts and she is tearing into him. And I'm like, what happened? Where did this narrative jump come from? Issue 30, to me, I was so lost. I was like, who is writing this story? It's the same person. It's like they forgot what they wrote in issue 29. It was like all of a sudden they're like, oh, I guess standard comic book procedure is for her to be unreasonably mad at the person. You know, God forbid we not do something cliche. Let's throw the cliche in there, even though we had sidestepped it in the previous issue.
I can't argue with it, because I thought that was weird too. I mean, even if she was initially angry about it, she should have realized what was going on.
But she explicitly... The thing is like there's no connective thread between those issues. At the end of 29, the villain shows up and she's like, oh crap, we've got to go at this. And then issue 30 starts and the villain's just casually standing there in typical comic book fashion while the other two hash out their problems. If I didn't know for a fact that this was the same writer, I would be like, this was picked up by somebody who didn't know what was written in issue 29. It makes no sense.
No.
I'm sorry. It just, like, I was so lost. I exclaimed out loud. I was reading it and I was like, what? What is going on in this comic?
And my guess is, I'm wondering, this is the other thing I thought about. I wonder if the writer has to drop Xander as a character because John's going to be on hanging out with Supergirl now. That's what I thought. I was like, wait a minute. I wonder if they, in mid-direction, the writer was told, oh, well, you're not going to be using this character anymore, so you need to get rid of this character because John's going to be joining Supergirl instead. That's what I took away from it.
You're probably right. I mean, there's clearly this book has been messed with heavily by editorial direction, which is so frustrating. And both Marvel and DC are guilty of this, but they never learn. Like, this is how they've killed so many books in the past, is by doing things like this. Now, I will admit, in my opinion, this has not been a particularly great comic to begin with, but it has absolutely been hamstrung by editorial directives.
Yep.
I don't think they were trying to tell a great story, but they could have at least been allowed to tell the story that they were trying to tell.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I was starting to like that character, Xander. You know, we were starting to get to know him, and, you know, I thought he made a good companion for Supergirl. He, you know, he's an interesting character. He's from Kalu, which, you know, has ties to the Superman, Supergirl titles anyways. The other thing I liked about this character is he had a thing for history. So he was an archaeologist. So, you know, they could have had more adventures tying into the history of the universe that this character would know odd tidbits about. I thought it was a good fit for a team, you know, them being a team.
I'm not convinced that we won't see him again, but I would agree that his role has probably been forced to change a little bit. I still think we'll see him again, though.
All right, we'll see. I think, me personally, I think he's just going to disappear from the title. But we'll see if he shows up in Supergirl number 32, because we see in issue 31 and in the last issue of Superman we reviewed that Kara and John are teaming up with Crypto, and they're heading back to confront Gandila. So I'm guessing that's going to be the end of that storyline. We had a pretty cool fight scene in issue number 30, because it was mostly just the fight scene once we got past the Xandar stuff.
The action was cool, but in my opinion, poorly drawn.
Oh,
relatively speaking.
Dude, the artwork sucked in 30 and 31. Because we switched art. If you notice, we switched artists from 29.
It's impossible not to notice. It is, in addition to the bizarre narrative jump from 29 to 30, the art jump was jarring, to say the least.
The artwork was terrible. When we get, I think it's the end of issue 30, when they come face to face with Kal-El and John, they were drawn terrible. I was like, oh man, where did they pull this artist from?
It also, I wonder what you thought of this. I almost felt like occasionally the artist couldn't figure out how they wanted to draw Gandello and started drawing Icicle. Like, the character, I know this is weird because it's a crystalline character, but it started to look more male in how they were drawing her, and I was like, do you know what character you're drawing? Did they tell you? Because I legitimately was like, this looks more like Icicle than it looks like the character we've seen.
Yes, it was jarring. Oh, man. So, I hope they don't continue with this artist, because he sucks. I'm still intrigued with this title to find out what's going to go on, or, you know, how things are going to go between Kara and John, and where their mission's going to go after this Gandila story. Are you even interested in continuing reading the story?
Not really, to be honest with you.
I didn't think so.
It's not good. It's not well written. Like, the story that the writer's not, like you said, we stopped reading it because it wasn't that good. It wasn't good enough, even though, so it wasn't getting around to the story that we wanted to see. And then it wasn't, you know, like, that's fine if you're at least telling an entertaining story along the way. And it wasn't, in my opinion, it wasn't. And they also are scraping the bottom of the barrel with artists. This is not the first time we've gotten this level of art in this book.
No, it's not. But we're still going to review Supergirl number 32 at least to see where the story's going.
That's fair.
All right. That wraps up our comic book talk for this week. Let's take a short break. And when we come back, we'll talk Swamp Thing.
What is the Geekly Oddcast? It's a panel show of television.
I mean, seriously, where else was I supposed to go and watch Gomez Adams ride a rocket ship on a railroad track?
Gaming.
And the dice say 17.
Oh my god, 17 is Mystic Quest.
And whatever comes to mind.
Why does Zod need a starship?
Alternating Thursdays on the Geekly Oddcast.
Let's talk Swamp Thing, Season 1, Episode 4, Darkness on the Edge of Town. So Swamp Thing, Episode 4, opens up with a pair of locals in the swamp hunting for a cypress grove that the industrial loggers might have missed. And while clearing the scrub to get to the trees, one of the loggers dislodges a corpse from the tree, and it falls down on the character Todd, scratching his arm. Now the next day, we see Todd show up late to his shift at Delroy's with the scratch on his arm, and we see that it's kind of irritating him. And while he's washing dishes, he starts hallucinating about this rattlesnake, and we see it kind of coil up around his arm, and he freaks out, takes a knife, and just starts stabbing his arm. And when that doesn't do the trick, we see him shove his hand into garbage disposal and turn it on. Man, I thought I was going to freaking lose my lunch.
That was one of the hardest scenes to watch in this whole show so far. That was, oh, when he stuck his hand down the drain, I was like, no.
I know. Oh, man, but this story was good. We see that when he gets his hand out of there and they're trying to help him, the owner, can't remember the owner's name. Anyways, he ends up getting scratched. So the owner starts having hallucinations as well, and he sees robbers who break into the place when he was 12 and his mother gets killed. And he grabs a gun from behind the counter and tries to shoot some intruder he's seeing in his mind. When he runs out of ammunition, the sheriff tackles him, and she gets scratched in the process. And then later on in the episode, we see that the sheriff is hallucinating, and she pulls her gun into the crowded town hall. And we see Abby trying to help the sheriff snap out of it. And, of course, we see Danny tackles the sheriff. The guy who's supposedly going to be Blue Devil, Abby gets scratched. So we see her have to go to the swamp where Swamp Thing helps get the darkness out of her. I really enjoyed this episode a lot. I like the storyline to it.
It was a really cool story. I thought this was one of the most self-contained stories we've gotten so far.
Yeah.
I would think.
Now, when we had Angela on a few weeks ago, she had talked about some of the stuff she had talked about to us. I recognized when I started watching this episode. So I was like, oh, she's probably in this episode. So after I watched it, I went back through trying to find her in the background scenes. And she was in the scene in the crowded town hall where the sheriff has pulled her gun and Abby gets scratched. She's in a scene in the background shortly after Abby gets scratched. So I actually took a screenshot of that and sent it over to Angela and said, hey, is that you next to that dude with the beard in the back? And she confirmed it was. So that was pretty cool. I found her. I mean, she's only in there briefly. It was hard for me to capture it, but there she was. Thought that was pretty cool.
It is cool. The only thing I thought was a little silly, so to speak, with this one was that she's a doctor who specializes, right, in pathogens and how they spread. And it took her for like 3/4 of the episode to figure out that it was the scratch that was spreading it. I was like, you really didn't? Nobody thought, oh no, this person got a scratch on them, and then this person got a scratch on them. It seemed like a fairly easy red flag to notice, is all I'm saying.
Yeah, it might have been. But you know what? The episode would have been a lot more boring if that didn't happen.
Well, I mean, I don't know. I think you could have – you can know that that's what's doing it and not be able to prevent it. I think you can still tell the same story and have, I think, a little bit different tension. Because to me, we as viewers, we knew the solution.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I almost would have preferred if they were in there, like if the characters are all equally aware of it, but are struggling to figure out how to prevent or how to achieve the solution. You know what I mean? That was if And again, this is a minor thing because I really enjoyed this episode, but I was like, yeah, you could have done this, like, how they handled the spreading a little differently. Because I just, it didn't make sense to me how multiple characters were shocked that it was, oh, what? It's the Scratch? Yeah, obviously. What else could it possibly have been?
That didn't bother me as much as you. All right, the other thing that happens in this issue is we see Avery kind of manipulates his wife into taking in that little girl. Part of the problem is she wants to cut him off from the money. So he uses the girl who's just lost her, you know, who's lost her parents. He uses her to manipulate his wife into keeping his guy on the payroll, just so, you know, once she makes a connection with that little girl, he uses the fact that she might get sick again to keep on his research dude. So that was kind of interesting how he manipulated that. Plus it leads into our next issue.
Yeah, I like that plot point. I mean, this show's doing a great job with their characterization of Avery and how he's so manipulative in a way that makes him seem like the good guy to people.
Yes.
It's fascinating. It's really cool. The one thing that I should mention is one thing we've barely talked about is the fact Swamp Thing, the title character. It's incredible to me that this show is as good as it is despite featuring Swamp Thing in maybe, what, 15% of the show?
Yeah.
At most?
Yeah. You know what? I don't even care.
I'm not complaining. That's what I'm saying. It's incredible. This show is really good, and it barely even uses its main character.
It's so disappointing that it got canceled, especially after I watched this episode was good. My favorite so far is episode 5. So let's get into Swamp Thing season 1 episode 5. Drive All Night. I really love this episode because I love the ghost stuff in it. So Swamp Thing episode 5 sees the arrival of Phantom Stranger to the swamps of Moray, and he comes to Alec by boat asking questions to help Alec better understand his transformation into Swamp Thing. And the stranger tells Alec that if you listen, you can hear the trees telling you their stories collected from all over the centuries. And Alec mentions having seen ghosts in the swamp, but the stranger corrects him. He says these aren't ghosts, but the memories of the trees and the green that connects them. And we see Alec reaches out to a cypress tree and witnesses the day that Shauna was drowned in the swamp. And the stranger tells him that it's a warning. Someone that Alec knows is in danger from their past. Of course, we know who that is.
This was, I think, the first real true mention of the green that we've gotten so far. This was also the most Swamp Thing that I think we got as well. These last two combined, but particularly episode 5. It was really cool. Part of my, I'm wondering, especially watching episode 5, is if some of this stuff that we're getting is being, like, sometimes it feels like things are happening really quick. Because I wonder if they are putting stuff into episodes that was meant to be more spaced out.
That could be. Why, did you feel this one was a little rushed?
I wouldn't say rushed, but it was... I was surprised at once we got that initial interaction between Phantom Stranger and Swamp Thing, that was it. At least for now.
Yeah.
And I feel like if we had been... I could be wrong with this, but to me, it felt like we could have gotten more with the Phantom Stranger if we had, like, the show had the full order that it was originally, like, 13 or 15 episodes, whatever it was. Maybe that was all there was supposed to be, and I'm sure we'll see the character again later. But, like, that seemed brief, and then the weird way that the show has been trying to shoehorn in Blue Devil's story also feels like they're trimming the fat off of that quite a bit. I don't know. I could be wrong. It just sometimes some of this feels it's all good, don't get me wrong, but it feels like some of these scenes maybe are being more closely packed together than they were originally designed to be.
That could very well be true.
This episode was really busy in terms of trying to establish a lot of different things. Because they're trying to establish the Floronic Man, they're trying to establish Blue Devil, they're trying to continue to develop Swamp Thing while also telling Abby's story. Like, it all worked. This was a great episode, but it was also a lot. And I wonder if all of that was originally meant to be in this episode.
Yeah. I really liked when Danny tried to go to the edge of town. And because we got to, instead of them telling us he made a deal, we got to see more about the deal. You know what I mean? We see him try to leave town, and when he puts his arm, try to go past the sign, it burst into flame. I thought that was pretty cool way to show us instead of telling us that he's made a bargain. And we could probably guess with who.
I really like that we got that scene, because they kept saying like he needed to stay in the town, but it was always so vague. I was like, why? You know what I mean? So I like that we finally got like some, like you said, we got to see it. So we're like, oh, okay. That makes way more sense than just a general, I am bound to this town. What does that mean? We kind of see that.
Right. And he's trying to figure out what he has to do to be done with this bargain. And of course, he thought maybe saving the sheriff or Abby or whoever would let him leave town, and it still wasn't. So kind of feel sad for him.
Yeah.
I really like the ghost stuff in this episode too, with the little girl getting possessed and stuff. I was wondering, you know, maybe if they had the more episodes, I thought they were going to do more with her being tied to Swamp Thing, but they didn't. The ghost possession thing I thought was pretty cool, and how they tried to lure the mom, the evil spirit tried to lure the mom to the lake, and then they figure out, you know what, this might not actually be our daughter, this is something else.
Yeah, the core story for this was pretty spooky but really cool. I have to say, the one thing that I think is going to end up hurting the show if the cancellation doesn't change, or if another place doesn't pick it up, is that they are spending a lot of time trying to set up so many things. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like the story of this season is very good and is very intriguing, but they're clearly also trying to, I don't blame them, because of the idea is that you're making multiple seasons, but they're clearly trying to lay the seeds for future things with Blue Devil, with Floronic Man, with, you know, with these other things, and it just doesn't seem like they're going to have time. I mean, we finally got in episode 4 the first real tease/hint about Abby's dad. When she gets scratched, her nightmare thing is this faceless monster that's trying to tear her away from her mom, which we can assume is the dad, Arcane. And she just doesn't remember really what that was about or what was going on with that. And we probably won't get that this season. If anything, that'll be the tease at the end that never gets fulfilled.
You're probably right. That was probably what they were setting up for next season. I can see that already. The other thing,
and again, I can't show for this. I mean, when you're writing it, that's what you should do. I mean, you want to lay the seeds for future things, but unfortunately, because it got canceled, now we're getting all of these things that are never going to really play out to anything.
Yeah, and that's just so disappointing. The other thing I thought was we were having that relationship with the sheriff and Avery. I don't know if they were planning on playing that out over the long term, but it seems kind of extra right now. I don't know what you think.
Well, they had laid the seeds, like hinted that was something that was going on earlier. And I think this episode clearly, especially by the end of this episode, goes a long way to show that the corruption in the town runs beyond just Avery, right? That it's also the sheriff. And so the first kind of clue that we get within this episode that she's also corrupt on some level is the affair she's having with Avery. And then at the end of this, when she shoots the rat guy or whatever they call him, that corruption is, we see really the full extent. Like, this town, the problems in this town extend beyond just Avery.
Okay, that makes total sense of why they'd have that scene in there. I have to tell you, last two episodes were great, especially 5. It's been my favorite so far. And it's just disappointing having a different type of superhero show. Well, it's not really a superhero show, but, you know, this horror show that we could have had on the DC Universe app, you know, going away. Disappointed by it.
In my opinion, it's clearly better than Titans. Like, I liked Titans, but of the three, if you had to cancel one, it would have been Titans. To me, it was the weakest of the three shows they've done. And so it just does not make sense to me why they canceled it before it even really came out.
Yeah, I know. Well, we heard it was for creative differences. Apparently somebody at Warner Brothers did not like this, you know, this type of show. And I think it's awesome.
And the sad part is that there's really probably nothing the show can do to change the minds because of the nature of it being a subscription service. It's not like there's just realistically no way that there's going to be some sort of magical viewership spike or subscription spike. You know what I mean?
Right.
There's just, unlike with other shows like a Lucifer or something like that, where you can look at the ratings and things like that, like, you're already, because you're on the DC network, that's a limited audience, and there's fewer people to be like, you can't get as many people on the bandwagon, because how do you get people to see the show? So if you're like rallying the cause on Twitter, so to speak, Save Swamp Thing on Twitter, people might see that and might be intrigued, who might watch the show and want to agree with you. But if they don't, they have to go get the DC app. And while obviously we both highly recommend that they do that, that's just not realistic for most people.
You know, if this show was on Netflix, I think it would do really well.
Yeah, I mean, I think it would probably end up suffering the fate of most Netflix shows. I think it really would only get a second season at most. I don't know if you've seen this. I saw an article or something on it recently that Netflix cancels most shows before the third season. At the end of the third season, because after that, somehow the show, like, kickbacks and stuff get more expensive, and so it's the most cost-effective thing is to have a 3-season show.
Huh. I did not notice that.
Yeah, so I'm not meaning to be pessimistic, but I do think even if it was on Netflix, the most we would get is 2 to 3 seasons of it. Which would probably be 2 or 3 really good seasons, which is better than 1, but still.
Yeah. I don't know. It's just a bummer the show is going away.
Yeah.
Oh, well. Hopefully we have, you know, the rest of the season continues to be good, because we're, at this point, we're at the halfway point with episode 5, so.
That is, I have to admit, my one concern with this show is because it got cut down, I'm worried that the pacing is going to be weird, and that it's going to, you know what I mean? Like, it was meant to be I can't remember what the original order count was, if it was
13.
13. You know, it was originally meant to be a 13-part story, and it ends up, you know, you try and cram that down into 10. We'll see. I mean, everything's been good so far, so I, you know, I would imagine the rest will be good, but I do, my one concern is that the pacing starts to catch up on it, and it ends up being a little bit of an awkward landing.
When we watch the episodes, we'll see how it goes.
Yeah.
All right, well, that wraps up our episode for this week. Do you have a shout-out, Cletus?
Yeah, when we read the Justice League title, and they're in the multiverse, they have a lot of different little teams that they show. And one of them is from the Multiversity title. It's one of the ones I've not shouted out before. The Society of Superheroes. So Multiversity by Grant Morrison you can find it as a graphic novel, but it was also made up of essentially different number one issues, because the idea in theory, what he was trying to do, in addition to telling a story, was also like, here's an idea for a story. Here's issue one. Do something with that. Like, basically, like, offering the idea to openly to people, like, here's a story you could tell in a different universe. And one of them is the Society of Superheroes. It's really, so it's like kind of like Golden Age-y aesthetics. It's got the Justice Society heroes in it, like Dr. Fate and Adam, like the you know, the Justice Society Atom. It's pretty cool. And you can see them in the background of one of the shots in the Justice League issue we just read. And you can read it on the DC Universe app if you have that, in addition to the rest of the series as well.
Awesome. All right, and my shout-out for this week is I'm shouting out about Season 2 of Krypton. I've already watched the first three episodes that have come out, and I have to say it was much better than Season 1. So I'm really enjoying Lobo's character because he's basically just like he is in the comics. So it's really good what I've seen so far. All right, if you want to comment on anything we've talked about tonight, you can reach us at our feedback line at 317-564-9133. Leave us a message, or you can email us at earthstationdcu@gmail.com. All right, coming up next week, we will be talking Action Comics, Detective Comics, Dial H for Hero, Justice League Dark, The Terrifics, Wonder Woman, and Swamp Thing Season 1, Episode 6. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time.
Atomic batteries to power. Turbines to speed.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network. Be part of the crew and help support our shows by donating to our ESO Patreon or by shopping through Amazon.com or the TeePublic store, which can all be found at www.esonetwork.com. The ESO Network, your station for all things geek.